You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 12th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Hello.
So this is the last show we'll be recording before we leave on our Down Under tour.
So exciting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this show's going up on November 22nd. Live shows are always fun.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we don't record enough together. It's just such a fun dynamic when I can actually see your goofy faces.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Bob.
Here you go. Yeah,
it is. It's a ton of fun to do those shows together. And it's not just the show, but we get to see each other before and after. And
it has a whole different vibe to it. We're seeing each other. We're seeing a live audience as we're recording it. It just takes on really a different tone. And
so November 22nd.
Yeah.
Nice segue.
Okay. So on Friday, November 22nd in 1963, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and people still are fighting about whether or not he was assassinated by one person or two or the entire CIA, et cetera, et cetera.
Military-industrial complex, the Cubans, the Russians, the Mafia.
The Mafia, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All the above.
Yeah. Pick your Marilyn Monroe, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Joe DiMaggio.
So... Yeah, everybody pretty much knows the basic details of it, but it was in Dallas, Texas. He was assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald, who then was later killed by Jack Ruby, which only added to the conspiracy theories, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I think still people believe there's a conspiracy, maybe even more than believe
there's a conspiracy
back when it happened. Apparently, last year, a Gallup poll showed that 61% of Americans believed a conspiracy theory. 61%.
Wow.
That's incredible.
That is amazing.
It's become a part of the culture to believe that there was a grand conspiracy of some sort behind the assassination of President Kennedy.
The pristine bullet.
It's ingrained. It's hard to, once it takes hold, it's very difficult to get out. Very difficult. No amount of evidence changes the minds of people.
But you have to create the counter meme almost, you know, of that the conspiracy theories themselves are a hoax, that they're fake. So people like having the inside track. If that becomes the inside track, if all those conspiracy theorists are wrong, then yeah, that could take hold. But yeah, I mean, I don't think we're ever going to weed out JFK conspiracy theories. It's too big an event. Something big must have been behind it. You know, just a lone nut doesn't sit right.
I remember we interviewed the author of Case Closed.
Gerald Posner.
Posner. Now that I found that interview very enjoyable, mainly because his approach was so effective and fascinating. He would, you know, he didn't talk a lot about the things you would expect. He talked about all the events leading up to the event itself and just those events themselves. You don't even have to look at any of the evidence or anything that happened that day. But Lee Harvey's life up to that point, to me, makes such a compelling case that he did it and he was the only one, that you really don't even need to look at anything else.
Yeah, I mean, what Posner said was that he did what most other JFK assassination historians failed to do, and that was take an actual look at Lee Harvey Oswald. You know, they're busy looking at the conspiracy theories, but he said, let's take a look at Oswald and see if that story hangs together, and it totally does. He said it was case closed, and I think that that's legitimate. Do you guys know about the Umbrella Man?
Oh, yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, so there was one man standing on the side of the road holding a black umbrella. He was the only person there who was holding an umbrella.
It was opened.
Yeah, he was holding an opened black umbrella over his head. And he was basically standing right at the point where JFK started to get shot, where the shots were coming into the car. And so it seems like, well, why is that the only person in Dallas? It's a sunny day. Why does he have an umbrella? What's he doing there? It can't be a coincidence. It seems sinister. And so that has been a part of the JFK assassination lore since the beginning. But it turns out, do you guys know what the holding an umbrella?
Yeah, it was a protest.
Yeah, it was a protest. And it wasn't a unique or quirky one. It was actually an established protest against Kennedy's father.
Mm.
Oh, Joseph Kennedy.
Joseph Kennedy, because he was, I guess he was the ambassador to the UK. So he worked with Neville Chamberlain. And Neville, some people thought that Chamberlain was an appeaser, that he had a policy of appeasement towards Hitler. And the open umbrella, because Chamberlain walked around with an umbrella, carrying an open umbrella was a form of protest against Chamberlain and his policies. And so the man who was holding the umbrella, who was identified and actually testified to this fact before Congress, the man was Louis Stephen Witt. So he said, yeah, it was, he just was like in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong thing. Like he thought it would be a cute protest because against Kennedy, because the Kennedy family apparently is really sensitive to this whole issue of, you know, of the appeasement claim against Chamberlain and Kennedy. So anyway, he obviously felt really bad about the protest after the fact, because then Kennedy gets assassinated and he's standing like an idiot holding an umbrella, and they ended up getting dragged before Congress to testify about it. But so that's a thing that when I wrote about this recently, it was to point out the fact that this is, it's a quirky anomaly, and history is full of quirky anomalies that you might not be able to explain at first blush. But that's just the nature of reality. You know, it's just the way of the world. But if you are intent on looking for things that seem superficially sinister to imply that there's a conspiracy, you will find them. They will be weird, quirky shit in any complex historical event, like some guy standing there with an umbrella because he's using a 20-year-old protest against Kennedy's father. You know,
it helps to know your history at a time like that, frankly. How many people know about Joe Kennedy and Neville Chamberlain and stuff? I don't know. Do they still teach that today in school? I don't even know.
I don't know.
But
all right. Well, we have an interesting show for you this week. We had a lot of requests to review the movie Interstellar. So we all went to see it. And now we're going to review it. So Interstellar is a science fiction movie. And of course, the usual spoilers galore coming. So
have to spoil it.
There's no way we could. Yeah, there's no way we can talk about the ins and outs of this movie without completely spoiling it. So skip past this section if you want to see the movie without the spoilers. So who wants to go first? First of all, just what did you guys think about the movie?
I loved it.
I liked it. I didn't love it.
I was between like and love. I really, really enjoyed it. I went with my daughter, Ashley. She absolutely loved it. She considered that one of the best movies she's seen. And if you know the nature of the movie, it made it especially poignant for me because of the relationship between the father and the daughter. Yeah. It really brought a couple tears to my eyes at a couple spots.
To me, those were some of the deepest moments of the movie, was the interaction between the daughter and the father, without question.
Right. I did enjoy it. It didn't, maybe it didn't quite meet my expectations, but it was pretty close. The science, yes, there were science issues and we're going to talk about them, but I could suspend my disbelief and just deal with that. That doesn't ruin the movie for me. It's fun to talk about the science and where it went wrong. Don't take that to mean that because of that, the movie sucked, because that's not the case.
And, you know, before we get into the science problems and successes, there's one thing that Neil deGrasse Tyson was tweeting about, actually, that I thought was really great to point out, which is that all of the lead characters are scientists or engineers, and of the lead characters, 50% are women, which never happens. It was kind of awesome. You know, regardless of what other problems you have going on, like, I think that's a good thing that we should commend the film for doing.
Yeah, the movie did a lot of things right. I overall, it was an enjoyable experience. I enjoyed the movie as a film, as a piece of entertainment. It was riveting in parts. There were definitely emotional moments. And I do want to say, because we do occasionally review science fiction movies, and then there's always this response of, why are you bothering to nitpick the science in science fiction movies? It's fiction. Just enjoy it. So please don't email us to tell us that, because we don't want to hear that. We're reviewing the science in science fiction movies for two reasons. One, because it's a fun way to talk about science.
Word.
Right? It's just a fun way to talk about what was right and what was wrong. You will learn about science. It's a good exercise to try to figure out whether or not something is accurate or not. It's a learning experience, so get over it. And the second thing is science fiction movies work better when the science works. Sorry, that I firmly believe that. I think that bad science in science fiction. First of all, if you're going to make a fantasy movie, make a fantasy movie. If you're going to make science fiction, at least think about the science. You can make shit up. That's fine. We will give you the gimmies. That's okay.
But there were some gimmies here.
Oh yeah, there's contrivances and gimmies to make the story happen, and you can forgive those. But you know, if you're just being lazy about the science and you're getting it wrong, really for no reason, it's just laziness, and it pulls you out of the movie because it's a howler. It's just so bad. That's bad writing. That's bad storytelling. So that's the two reasons why we talk about the science and science fiction movies. So anyway, does somebody want to give a quick overview of the plot so we could frame the discussion? Then we'll get into what worked and what didn't work.
Sure, I'll do it. And first, I'll say what I thought as well quickly. I did enjoy the movie. I enjoyed watching it. I thought the science was handled wonderfully. However, I thought that there was an undertone of sentiment in the movie that was very difficult. Yeah, there's a Phil I know that likes this movie. There's a Phil I know that doesn't like this movie. but it was a good movie, but it was so sad. It was relentlessly sad, and it kept getting sadder, and it really got to me, I think. But trying to put that aside, it was shot wonderfully. It was, the acting was superb. Matthew McConaughey was just, he's just excellent. I kept thinking of his character from the TV show. What was that show?
True Detective.
True Detective.
The basic plot is that it's in Earth's future. I was guesstimating 50 to 100 years. And what's happening is it seems that the Earth is now unable to sustain enough food for the population. So through a series of a couple of weird experiences, Matthew McConaughey's character finds a base, like a military base. It ends up being NASA, and he finds out that NASA not only still exists, but is planning has these missions that they're planning and have already sent people on to find another planet to populate. And they recruit Matthew McConaughey's character to do this, to be one of those astronauts.
Because he's a pilot. Yeah. Yeah,
because he's a NASA test pilot.
And known to Michael Caine, who is the lead of the NASA project.
Physicist.
And it's also very important to mention, though, that they discovered a wormhole by Saturn, by which they can use to traverse to another galaxy, it seems, to these other planets that are right on the other side of the wormhole. So that's how they solve that problem, because otherwise it would be a joke. And I loved McConaughey's line. He's like, it would take thousands of years to travel there. It's beyond futile to even attempt it. And it's like, yes, normally you would be right, but we have a handy wormhole that we just found. So that was nice.
Yeah, and that was a plot element. We didn't just happen to discover a wormhole.
Oh, it was a
Saturn.
Key. Right, it was a key plot.
It was placed there. The wormhole was placed there for us to save the Earth. Placed by whom is, a plot point.
Assumed because on the other side of the wormhole, they had sent probes through and found that there were a load of stars with Earth-like planets just on the other side.
12 planets, I think they said.
Yeah. So it was like too perfect. It seemed pretty obvious that it was placed there.
What worked, a couple of things. Before we get to the science, I have to mention that early on in the movie, Matthew McConaughey is at a parent-teacher conference.
Yes.
And his daughter's in trouble because she was talking about the fact that humans went to the moon in the last half of the 20th century. And the school administrator was saying that, well, everyone knows that that was a hoax. That was a good piece of propaganda
to bankrupt
the Soviet Union. Like, it was taken now as the officially state-sanctioned wisdom that the Apollo landings were a hoax. They did that really well because what I liked about that, it wasn't random. What she was saying was she was reinterpreting history through the lens of the current culture and the current narrative needs. So at that point, the world was dying. And they couldn't spend any time or resources on science or machinery or engineering. They had to spend all their resources on farming. And so dreaming about building machines and going to the moon was a distraction from what they were doing to stay alive. And so the narrative became, of course we didn't do this fantastic thing by building machines. That it was all a waste of resources and we need to focus on farming. That was, and so they did that really well. It wasn't just a random thing that they, that plot point that they were bringing up. And of course, McConaughey's response was good, but
yeah, that was very well done. Very well done. A little spooky to think that that, you know, you're saying to yourself, that won't really happen 80, 100 years from now. But then you think in the back of your mind, oh,
sure,
maybe,
would.
You know, why, yeah. Why couldn't?
Yeah, I mean,
and that is a scary thought.
Yeah. The setting that they've set up allows, I think, for a lot of leaps, in that respect. You know, we're talking about something that's bordering on a post-apocalyptic world. You know, we're talking about,
Pre-post-apocalyptic.
Pre-post-apocalyptic. Thank you.
Pre-post-apocalyptic.
Perfect. And for me, that excused a lot of things that would otherwise be plot holes, like, huge spoiler alert here, Michael Caine revealing at the end that he's been lying to everyone the entire time in order to get humanity basically to work together towards this goal. He's been lying to them and pretending as though they had a chance to get off the planet as opposed to doing quote-unquote plan B, which was seeding a new planet with human life in order to continue the species.
Yeah, frozen embryos, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. My first thought when that was happening was, come on, like the guy in charge of NASA is single-handedly holding on to this one, you know, that's a conspiracy theory right there. And I brought this up with my boyfriend who pointed out, like, look, there's like six people in charge of NASA now. Government doing oversight. So, yeah, like that world that they've built, I think allows for things like that to happen. And also for like a random English guy to be in charge of the United States space program.
It's Michael Caine. He's a Chris Nolan favorite. What do you want?
Okay, so let's get to some of the science. The first bit of real hardcore science we get to is the wormhole. And the special effects there I thought were great because, you know, wormhole would be a sphere.
Which they explained perfectly, like exactly the way that a physicist would explain it.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. The explanation of what a wormhole is was great. The visual representation of it was great. Yeah.
The gravitational lensing.
Let me expand on that a bit, Steve, because one of the things I really liked on the build up to this movie was the fact that the director Nolan, Chris Nolan, used physicist Kip Thorne as an advisor. And Thorne is – he really needs no introduction. This guy is the Feynman Professor of Theoretical Physics at Caltech. He's an expert at determining the implications for astrophysical phenomenon of Einstein's general relativity. This guy knows his stuff. And he actually
– thanks for the introduction.
He actually fed Nolan the equations – general relativity equations so that they could then render them in the computer graphics engine. And they had to build, they had to write a renderer because a typical renderer assumes that light's traveling in straight lines. The one that they had couldn't do the curved lines. It had to be for the lensing effect. So the big claim to fame then for this movie is that it was the most realistic representation of a black hole ever done in cinema. Kip Thorne claims that he's going to get a couple of papers. He's going to get papers published out of the work that they did, one for the astrophysics community, one for the computer graphics industry.
Oh, awesome.
So,
Bob, you're saying this is more accurate than the movie The Black Hole, that Disney film from the 70s?
Hey, come on. Yeah. That was fun when it came out.
It was. But it was beautiful. And if that's how it really looks, that's, you know, the fact that this is what they think it would really look like if you were right there. It was beautiful because you could see the arc, the distorted gravitationally lensed light around from the light from the accretion disk around the entire sphere and then across the front of it. It was quite beautiful.
To point out, there is a wormhole and a black hole. There's two different phenomena that we're talking about here, right? They go through the wormhole near Saturn. Then they show up in this other galaxy, you know, far, far away. And for this mission, this is a follow-up mission. So already there's been essentially 12 missions, manned missions or peopled missions to the 12 potential worlds. And they know that only one of them is actually going to survive. The other 11 are going to die alone on their world. Mm-hmm. The most promising one, the rescue mission will go there, set up the new colony with the frozen embryos, and then return to Earth to bring back as many people as I guess they can from Earth to recolonize it. In the meantime, Professor Brand, Michael Caine's character, is going to solve the physics problem of quantum gravity so that they could launch everybody off the Earth. I guess they were building these space stations on Earth. But if right. they once they figured out the whole gravity thing, they would be able to launch them into space and would then that would save all the people on Earth. But Kane knew that this was impossible, or that, you know, he solved half the equation and he knew that he couldn't solve the other half. They would need information. They would need quantum data from within a black hole, from within an event horizon, in order to solve the equation.
I had a problem with that.
That's the biggest contrivance of the movie.
Yeah.
If you're going to unit the unification of general of relativity and quantum mechanics, that's the one, the true holy grail of physics. They speak different mathematics. They cannot communicate. So that's a problem. They're trying to unify them, but you don't need to look in a black hole, which is impossible. I don't care, you know, what happens in the movie. It's impossible. Anyway, but you
that's
don't.
That's where information
but you
disappears
don't, you
into.
You don't need to look there to do this. This is, many people believe, a solvable problem. I don't know how long it's going
to
take. It could take 50 more
Five
years.
To 10 years.
It could take a long time, but I think it's an inherently solvable problem. And they just assumed, yep, you need to look at a black hole before we can get this information. No, you don't have to.
Well, they don't necessarily assume it, but like I thought that the assumption was that Michael Caine did think he could solve it at the beginning, but then realized that he couldn't. He like ran
it
into
was
a
futile.
Wall.
That's an acceptable science fiction contrivance to drive the plot. Sure. That was fine. Yeah. May not be true, Bob, but I give that.
Yeah.
That's a small thing to play. All right.
Just saying.
They decide to go to the system that has a black hole in it. Because there are three potential worlds there. So now they're just maximizing their odds. Of the 12 worlds, three of them are in one system. That's the system they're going to for their follow-up mission to see which one of these three worlds is habitable. And, of course, it's right next to a friggin' black hole. So
wait, not just right next. These planets were effing orbiting the black hole.
They were orbiting right. the black hole.
It's like,
yeah.
What? Wait a second. Where's the star? How are they getting light? How are they getting heat?
How did
and
they
warm?
Form planets like, in the first place? I mean, would a planet form?
Well, probably not. But no, probably not. It could have conceivably could have snatched the planets from a star that got sucked in. I guess.
Rogue planet, maybe.
But yeah. The idea of going to a planet that's in orbit around not just a black hole, but a supermassive black hole. And not just a supermassive black hole. This is gargantuan. This is, you know, hundreds of millions of solar masses, one of the biggest black holes supposedly around. So it's like, wow, what the – I can't – how it would be cool, of course, to be in orbit around a black hole. But what the – I mean, come on. How
– So, Bob, would the black hole give off enough light to act as a sun?
No, not at all. Not even the accretion disk. You're not going to get any light from a black hole except Hawking radiation, which really, you know, isn't really light. The accretion disk is incredibly hot. It's giving off X-rays, amazingly, blazingly hot. But no, it's not going to be enough to warm these planets. No, that's not
plot wise though, Bob. Maybe you can answer this. Plot wise, why couldn't they have a sun at the center of this solar system, but a black hole nearby the sun? Because the sun
I think a little bit more feasible.
I think that's what the situation was. Because when they first arrive, they're clearly right near a star.
Yeah, I saw that too, Steve. And I thought, oh, okay, that's a star. But then, kind of later on, I was thinking, wait, was that the glow of the black hole? And then other articles I've been reading online. There was no mention of this star. So maybe you could make the case that there was a star there, but they seem to be pointing that it wasn't.
There was a glow around the event horizon, which looked cool. There's a lot of lensing effects going on,
yeah.
Which I guess is really what we were seeing, just a lensing effect. But the black hole was clearly not feeding. There wasn't a massive swirling accretion disk and X-rays being shot out of the black hole. So – because you're right, Bob. I mean, anything in the vicinity would be fried if the black hole were feeding.
Right. And not just fried, Steve. I mean, you have – this is a supermassive black hole after all. There would be stuff flying through that area of space to be sucked into the black hole. Not a safe neighborhood for planets. You would eventually – something eventually would hit you. Or you would.
So what did you guys think of the time dilation?
I loved it. That was one of the first times that I've seen – that sort of thing dealt with as there's serious repercussions to this that they can't go back on, you know. And I liked that they were immediately like, you know, no, this is done, you know, 24 years have passed or whatever. I thought that was really cool because you normally don't see that represented that way.
That's right. For audiences who aren't familiar with how time dilation works, this was a pretty good example of that and pretty easy for people to understand.
Yeah, if you park yourself next to a black hole, the intense gravitational distortion of space-time makes time run slower for you. So they had to visit Miller's planet, which was the one that was in close orbit around the black hole. And every hour they spent on that planet, 7 years passed on Earth, you know, for reference. So they get stuck there for a little bit and they come back to their orbiting ship. And the guy they left behind there was there for 23 years by himself in the mothership.
That was another thing that I thought they mishandled a little bit because that guy's reaction was he just like he opens the door when they come back.
Yeah, it's like, you're finally.
Oh, you're back. It's been a long time. It's like.
Yeah, 23 years alone. Like he would have been crazier, I think.
Yeah.
No, he had a robot. He had.
He did a couple of runs in his sleep, you know, in suspended animation.
Right. We don't know how long he slept, but my question was, how much food did he have? You say he lived a decade in his frame of reference. That's a lot of food. Where did that come from?
But well, I think no, Bob, because he. Well, wait. He did say he went to sleep twice.
Yes, but I'm assuming even if he slept for 15 years, which is he did not give that impression at all that he slept that long, that's still, you know, 7 years of food and crap in that place. That where did all that go? He could have injected it into the black hole.
Stink in that.
But guys, we got to go a little bit more
about time
dilation. Yeah, that's well true. Time dilation. We got to go a little bit deeper into time dilation. For me, I loved it as well. I don't often see it handled so well in any medium. And to me, one of the most poignant scenes in the entire movie was when he came back after being stranded on Miller's planet for just like, an hour or whatever. And he came back and he saw the videos of his kids grown up and he was crying. Oh my God, that was so moving. So that was an amazingly powerful scene. But my first thought was, wait a second. For such a drastic time dilation effect, that planet would have to be very, very close to the black hole. Yeah. So close that the tidal forces would just rip it apart. So that didn't make sense to me. But I was reading Phil Plait's blog and some other research. So it looks like because this was a spinning black hole, that means that there could possibly be a stable orbit around that black hole for a planet that would, have such time dilation effects. So that's not completely as far-fetched as you might think. And that's great because that makes it more interesting.
You mentioned the tidal forces and, you know, that was obviously a plot point where the tide had created these gigantic waves that killed Miller and nearly killed all of them. But when they land, like it's very, very shallow.
1 foot deep.
Yeah, which strikes me as, you know, and you can't really tell how far out. I don't know if they mentioned it, like how far out that shallowness went. But I would love to see some serious math on how big you can actually get a wave, no matter how strong the tidal force is, when you're working with a foot of water, basically.
Yeah.
Like it seemed a bit impossible.
I would like to see that, but there's too many unknowns, I think, Rebecca. First off, you're right. We don't know how deep it was elsewhere. And we're also dealing with tremendous tidal forces. And remember, a wave at the seashore crests only because it's getting very shallow and all the water is building up on itself, and that's why waves get so high. It's because it's getting so much so shallow. And I'm just talking about normal waves there. But yeah, that struck me as well. Wait, can you have a mountain, a literal mountain of water with that so shallow? But remember, there's a lot of water to draw from. Even if the whole planet was that shallow, that's a lot it's a lot of places to pull the water from. So who knows?
And didn't they say gravity on that planet was 130% that of Earth?
So
you had more gravity. That would be even a larger challenge to get waves that size.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but it's a black hole though.
Guys, what did you think about the frozen cloud and how would that be suspended?
X-ray should have boiled off the water. But
the frozen cloud was the dumbest bullshit that in the whole movie. I think really.
And I read some reviews about
there was definitely a physicist in front of me at the movie theater because he cackled when they hit the frozen cloud.
I was like, "What the hell just happened?" Right. It was bizarre. Right.
It's like, is that a cave?
At first. At first, I thought it was cool because it was probably the last thing I ever expected. But then, of course, I was thinking, how the hell is that going to work?
Quantum gravity?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
All right, guys, let's talk about the big black hole thing. Okay. So he enters the black hole towards the end of the movie, and instead of him turning into spaghetti, like Bob has said so many times,
spaghettification.
You know, he survives, and he actually comes down onto something that kind of seems like a structure.
They call it a tesseract, which is I love tesseracts; they're really cool. Basically, a tesseract
is a four dimensional
cube. Imagine a cube, a solid three dimensional cube. Put another smaller cube right in the middle of it on the inside, and then connect all the corners from the big cube into the corner that's closest to the inner cube. And what you're looking at then is basically a three-dimensional representation or shadow of a four-dimensional hypercube. And so they call it a tesseract. And it makes a lot of sense because it's supposedly this is a three-dimensional representation of five-dimensional space, and they called it the tesseract. So that was cool.
But it was five-dimensional because one of the dimensions was time.
Right.
Because in this structure, this tesseract, he had access to, well, at least a long stretch of time connecting back to his daughter's bedroom.
Yeah.
This is the point where we enter
that
fantasy.
That was strange.
Yeah, this is the fantasy part. But so if you try to make sense of it, and this is actually one of my biggest film problems with the movie, meaning just as a work of film, McConaughey explains everything at the end. It's like, really? Do you, you know, it was took away from the story because they said, oh, this is humans from the future built this, not aliens. It's like, you didn't have to say that. A little bit of mystery when you're at the center of a black hole in a tesseract, you know, you could leave a little bit of mystery in there for our imagination. So it's like,
that's a good point.
Let me just lay out the entire backstory here and take away all the mystery from what's happening. That was unnecessary. It was just from a film point of view, I think that was unnecessary, but I mean, it made an interesting connection because at the beginning of the movie, his daughter thought there was a quote-unquote ghost in her room because strange things were happening. And then now it turns out that McConaughey is the ghost because he has pseudo-access to her room through this tesseract. And he's communicating to her by knocking books off the shelf and sending gravity waves back there to arrange the dust into binary code and things.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's why I thought that this part was weird. And let me get through my idea here. So, if I understood things correctly, humans from the future, and they could have been insanely far in the future.
Well,
But
they had total control over a black hole.
Yeah,
because it didn't kill him when he went into the black hole. They also created a five-dimensional object in the black hole to allow him to see the complexity of time and space, and for him to actually interact with his daughter from the past,
right,
which is incredible, an incredible feat of technology. And that whole scene, I couldn't help but think, is it just one big metaphor for something? Why did the filmmakers go there? Why did they do that? Was it just a plot device, or were they trying to say something to us? Because I couldn't.
What they were saying was cheesy, which was that it was his connection of love to his daughter is what saved the Earth. I mean, that was the connection that was palpable and that was real. And okay, that was just his character's interpretation of that, which is fine.
Well, not just Hurst. He was also the scientist with him. What's her name?
Brand.
Yeah. She did say things like, which for me was the crunchiest part of the movie, was that, you know, she says love is an artifact of a higher dimension transcending the limits of time and space. And she said, remember her question? She said, why do we love people after they're dead? You know, what utility does that serve?
Right.
And that was kind of silly. And they were playing off of what she said, kind of proving actually what she said. And to me, that was just like, well, whatever, you know, I didn't.
Cause FYI, we also hate people after they're dead. So does that mean hate is
that
also
serves utility?
Yeah. Right. This is another moment when the guy in front of me, when she started going
chortled
off on all that,
yes,
he goes loud enough for pretty much everyone to hear, well, she's gone nuts.
I love that guy. I officially love that guy.
Yeah,
that
was great.
But just for the record, though, I really didn't have barely a moment of any issues after he entered the event horizon. I know for a supermassive black hole that you actually wouldn't be necessarily spaghettified the moment you travel through the event horizon. It would actually kind of could be serene in many ways because it's just so big that it would take time for any the nasty stuff to happen. Now, the only problem I did have after that is that the imagery was kind of like, what? He was going through like these sparks and stuff and this debris, these little minute pieces of debris. Like, what? That's not how I imagined an event horizon. Then he entered the Tesseract. And once he did that, I had no problem at all because it was a huge gimme, because this was a construct by these five-dimensional future advanced humans, and to me all bets were off. Nothing mattered at that point.
That was exactly like you're through the obelisk in 2001.
Yes.
Anything that happens on the other side of the obelisk, you're not even talking about conventional science or
anything
anymore.
From a scientific perspective.
That's right, because we don't know.
From a scientific perspective, though, I have seen several physicists comment that this was an incredibly accurate creation of a Tesseract, which I thought is commendable.
Well,
if they
the Tesseract was cool. It was cool.
Accurate. An accurate way to represent a Tesseract.
I loved when it was collapsing at the end, collapsing in on itself.
That was cool.
After he was feeding her the information and they were figuring out how to get back, essentially back through.
You know, one thing I wanted to mention is if anybody enjoyed the film, but then at that point just sort of lost it and couldn't handle the leap there, the fantastical leap, you know what? He died in the black hole. There. Everything else was the dream he had in his last few moments of life.
All right. So this has to be another gimme as well, though. So as he's falling into the black hole, time would be running slower and slower and slower for him. Mm-hmm. So by the time he even gets into the Tesseract, millions of years would have passed.
Oh, yes. Steve, I didn't think about that. Yes. Well, wait, don't forget.
Absolutely.
The future humans have total control over
space, time,
and gravity.
So they have to put him back in time.
To a point.
Which, if they can do that, then why not just put him back in the first place to go tell his younger self what his self needed to know?
Rebecca, what that means is that they're really just messing with him.
Right.
They put him back in time so that his timeline would be in sync with the girl, with Brand.
Yeah.
And not in sync with, say, his children.
Yeah.
I thought the film was beautiful. The acting was fantastic. The story was mostly great. Like I said, it was emotionally difficult, but I'm so excited about how well science was handled in this, and that, you know, obviously the producers and the director and the writers talked to scientists, and that is encouraging.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic experience on that part all along.
And so, science was in a way the hero of the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
It was. So that was good. I mean, it wasn't, scientists weren't these, you know, maniacal villains.
Yes, good
and
point.
They were real people who were, you know, had problem solving skills and knowledge, and they were using them to save the freaking Earth. And
it was a very humanistic message.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Brand, at one point talks about the nature of evil and how where they're going, there isn't going to be any evil. And so, of course, when they get there, and she compares it to, you know, a lion bringing down a gazelle. And then when they get to Matt Damon's character, obviously he was lying. Like, obviously. I was just waiting for them to
really
one. Oh yeah. As soon as they said, like, oh yeah, they'll just go. And if the planet is safe, then they'll give us a signal and we'll come pick them up. Like, obviously everybody's out there frantically hitting their save button. You know? So he turns on them, and I thought it was really beautifully done, because it was like, he wasn't evil. He just had this survival instinct, and that's what was coming up, exactly like a lion taking down a gazelle. And I found that to be a very humanistic message, especially combined with Michael Caine lying all these years and causing a great amount of hurt to the people around him, but at the same time, like, he had the greater human race in mind at the time, and so it's understandable. And again, like, humanistic, even though it could be seen out of context as like an evil act.
I know. I agree on that point, Rebecca. They were very good at including human frailty and human strength in this film, right? I think both of those men showed extraordinary character. When you say the Michael Caine character and the Matt Damon character were both weak and incredibly strong at the same time in different ways. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, agreed.
definitely a different movie, an experience, definitely worth seeing. You know, as a scientist, skeptic, critical thinker, it has a lot, I think, to go for this movie.
Oh, and by the way, no sounds in space.
Yes. No sounds in space. Oh, which I...
Can we talk about the sound?
Which I love. I love that. For me,
it heightens it.
Oh, yeah. It makes those scenes seem... There's just something awesome about that.
When Matt Damon gets his ship blown up, it was like so powerful, I thought. Yeah. You know, to suddenly cut back and just see bits...
Or how about this? I think one of the best examples of that in the movie was when they were in the interior of the wrecked ship at the end, and you see smoke pouring out of a vent, and you hear nothing, but then when the air rushes in, the sound slowly increases. That was very powerful.
All right, guys, that was a lot of fun. If you want us to review other science fiction movies, send us your recommendations because we enjoy doing this every now and then. All right, well, guys, we're going to get to a few news items. Evan, you're going to start by telling us about, finally, we have a probe landing on a comet.
Oh, yeah. This one has been a decade in the making, and even longer than that if you think about it, because it took time to plan this whole thing before 10 years ago when they even launched the damn thing. In any case, it's called Rosetta, and it's a robotic space probe built and launched by the European Space Agency. Its mission... And I'm quoting this directly from their website. To chase, go into orbit around, and land on a comet. It is studying the Jupiter family comet 67P with a combination of remote sensing and in situ measurements. The spacecraft arrived at the comet on the 6th of August, 2014, following a 10-year journey through the solar system. And what a journey it was. And since then, the spacecraft had been orbiting the comet, gathering data to characterize the environment and the comet's nucleus. But now, as of today, November 12th, which was arguably the most exciting part of the mission, it took place when the lander named Philae detached from the Rosetta probe and achieved the first ever controlled touchdown onto a comet's nucleus. Awesome! Way to go, humans.
Super cool.
It landed, yes, but it wasn't a complete success as far as latching on to the comet. It had this harpoon anchoring device, which is supposed to shoot out and pull it in, essentially securing it to the comet.
Like Batman.
Exactly. And the comet's gravity is very, very weak. Very weak. So much so that the lander itself, which weighs about 220 pounds on Earth, weighs about a half an ounce on this
comet. Yeah, so, you could fart and go into orbit, basically.
Yes.
Well, that's why they didn't send a human.
Yeah.
So they designed this so that it would secure it to the comet so it wouldn't just kind of hit and bounce back off the comet. Yeah. It has to be able to latch itself on. And unfortunately, the harpoon did not work. But the legs of it had these, as they described them, screws built into the bottom of them to secure itself into the surface of the comet. And that part worked okay. There was also a third mechanism, a thruster built at the top of the device, which was supposed to kind of give a push down, sort of pushing on the head of it down onto the comet. But that also did not function correctly. So it's really only hanging on by its feet. And it actually bounced once, is from what I heard, and sort of turned during the course of that bounce. And then it came finally to rest. So I don't know if that makes a difference really in as far as the effectiveness and the data that they're going to be able to collect from it or not. So the news is still developing on this because it all just happened today. And by the time you listen to this, there may be some more updates in regards to this. But this is where we stand at the moment.
Okay, let's move on. Do you guys know what a feeling of presence is? Have you ever had this happen to you? Have you ever
felt? Yes.
There was
like
some,
when a ghost is watching you.
Yeah, like when a ghost is watching. I've had it when I get hypnagogia when I'm sleep deprived. And it can be powerful, a sense that there's another presence in the room with you or watching you. Well, a recent study looked at the neurological correlates of a feeling of presence. And two components of the research that was recently published. In the first part, neuroscientists looked at patients who had a feeling of presence following a neurological injury like a stroke, and they did a lesion analysis. So they looked to see, okay, where in the brain is the lesion in these patients who had a stroke and now have a pathological feeling of presence? Like much of the time they might feel like there's somebody watching them. And they found consistent correlations. Essentially, there was they found injury in the temporal parietal, insular, and the frontal parietal cortex. These parts of the brain are involved with the processing of sensory information as it relates to our sense of our own body. Lesions in these areas cause what are called own body illusions. So any sense that you're either floating outside your body, that you're located somewhere other than your body, that your body is elsewhere, etc., these are own body illusions, and they're related to these parts of the brain. So their hypothesis was, which is consistent with, you know, other published neuroscience, is that, and this is, I think, this is emerging as, I think, a basic understanding of one of the ways in which the brain works. The brain processes all of your sensory information in parallel and compares it together, right? So it's comparing your visual information, your tactile information, proprioception. Proprioception is your ability to feel where your limbs are in three-dimensional space. Vestibular information, which is a feeling of gravity and acceleration. It compares all of these sensory streams. And if they match, then that creates a powerful sense that you are in your body, that you own and control your body. If they mismatch, however, that can cause one of these own body illusions. And I've talked on previous episodes about things like phantom limbs or supernumerary phantom limbs, or being or feeling as if you're occupying a virtual avatar or a dummy arm. All you have to do to create this phenomenon, it doesn't work 100% of the time, but in a lot of subjects, 40, 50, 60% of the time, is just mess with the timing of these sensory streams. So the second part of this study, what the researchers did was they rigged up a setup where test subjects had a little robot arm in front of them that was a controller, and the controller controlled a little robot arm behind them that would essentially poke them in the back. And in one setup, they had the robot arm that was poking the subjects in the back timed exactly with the controller arm. And that created the illusion that they were touching or massaging their own back, right? Because as they moved, this thing happened in response in exact time. So the precise matching of the movement and the sensory outcome created that sense that they were the ones who were massaging their own back. Does that make sense? Then they delayed the robot arm by 500 milliseconds, which is half a second. In that setup, so now the robot arm seems to be moving of its own accord. It's out of sync with their own movements. And that created the illusion that there was another presence in the lab with them. So the subjects reported the powerful illusion of a presence or of being watched. They did this in 12 subjects. Two of them found the experience so disturbing they asked it to end immediately. They couldn't really get through the whole thing. This is, as far as I can tell, and this is what the researchers are claiming, the first reproduction in the lab of this particular sense of presence illusion, which is interesting. So we're getting better and better essentially at creating, at manufacturing at will, these types of illusions. I find this fascinating for a lot of reasons, you know, partly because this is something, you know, before I started studying this aspect of neuroscience, you'd take it for granted that we feel as if we are in our bodies and we own our bodies. It's the kind of thing, you know, you wouldn't think the brain has to actively produce that sensation. It's the kind of thing you might assume just emerges normally from the fact that you are your body and you do control your body. But actually, it's an active neurological process. Your brain has to actively compare these different motor and sensory streams. And that sense that you're in and control your body is a product of these things being synchronized precisely. And disruptions in any of these circuits can produce, or tricking them in an experimental setup can produce pretty reliably these powerful illusions that are very bizarre, like you're occupying something other than yourself, or in this case, another presence, that there's some other entity in the room with you. Your brain is putting it together in such a way that it says there's some other person here other than you. So the researchers also hypothesize, which I think is a perfectly reasonable extrapolation of their research, that this phenomenon may be an explanation for certain types of ghostly encounters or experiences. You know, people having a powerful sense of another entity in the room with them, it's just a brain glitch. You know, we could produce it in the lab.
Cool.
Brain glitch. You heard it here first. Ghosts are brain glitches. Because our brain, I know you don't like to think about it this way, is just a machine. It's a meat. What? It's a meat machine. That's all it is. Yeah, and it's glitchy. All right, Bob. So this Higgs roller coaster has just got to stop.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's all over the place. So our buddy Higgs is back in the news, and it's horrible and awesome all at the same time. a different team of scientists have vetted the CERN data, and they conclude that their confidence in finding the Higgs boson is misplaced. Apparently, the data, as it is now, can support the discovery of other particles with as much confidence as the Higgs itself, one of them being what's called the Techni-Higgs. T-E-C-H-N-I, Techni-Higgs. Never even heard of that before last week. So the Higgs particle, for those of you just back from the gargantua black hole environs, is the horribly named God particle that imbues mass to all particles in the universe that actually have it. Now, it's not the particle, of course, that's doing this. It's the Higgs field that permeates the universe. The discovery, of course, was made at the LHC, or Large Hadron Collider, near Geneva, Switzerland. If you remember, we mentioned on the show after the announcement in 2012 of the Higgs discovery that scientists made it quite clear that it was difficult to distinguish whether the particle they discovered was truly the Higgs as predicted by the standard model of physics or whether it was merely a Higgs-like particle. Still, though, after pouring through the petabytes of data, if it was that much, their confidence levels only seemed to increase in the months following the announcement of the discovery, and until pretty much everyone believed that, yeah, that's pretty much exactly what they found. It was the Higgs that they detected in their ATLAS and CMS experiments at the LHC. So, but as good little skeptics that we are, we know that you can't ever be a 100% certain in such things. And according to this other team of scientists, we need to seriously consider that what was found may not be the Higgs boson as we thought. Yeah, a quote from the Franson, his associate professor, he said that the CERN data is generally taken as evidence that the particle is the Higgs particle. It is true that the Higgs particle can explain the data, but there can be other explanations. We would also get this data from other particles. So what could it be then? So the big theory that everyone's talking about, that the LHC discovered a particle called the Techni-Higgs, this is similar to the Higgs boson, but it's different in some fundamental ways. This particle is not part of the standard model of physics. It's a different set of theories, that spawned this idea. It's not a fundamental particle. It's supposedly a composite particle composed of, here we go again, two techniquarks. Techniquarks. What the hell?
You hadn't heard that before.
How could I not hear these things? So these particles can pair up in multiple ways, one of which displays these boson-like properties that can be easily misinterpreted for the Higgs. The techniquarks, if they exist, of course, keep that in mind, they could not bind together to form other particles using the one of the fundamental forces of nature that we already know about. They would need a new, previously unproven force that they call the Technicolor force.
Technicolor.
Techni everywhere, right. So this name is obviously, it's derived from the color force, which binds together the conventional quarks. So there's lots of similarities, but there's also some very interesting differences. Like it's a high energy force. It would really manifest at very high energies. So this new force would be just amazingly, fantastic news if it's ever confirmed. It would be a fundamental force of nature. That reason alone would make this a major discovery. Clearly, I think that would be a shoo-in for a discovery of the year or even the decade, I think. A new force is, I mean, how often does that happen?
That doesn't come by very often. When's the last time they discovered a new fundamental force?
Well, I mean, yeah, right?
It's 100 years ago?
I can't even remember. So in addition, this new particle force, could be responsible for
for mass instead of the Higgs boson. So in a way, it would do away with the Higgs boson as the conventional one that we've been thinking about. Even better, perhaps, it's theorized that that a different configuration of these technoquarks could potentially form dark matter. Dark matter, that would be amazing if we got out of this not just a new force, but also some really solid information about what the hell dark matter is. So that'd be great. Keep in mind that these scientists have not disproved the discovery of the Higgs. They're pointing out that the evidence today supports the existence of other particles potentially as equally as well as the Higgs boson. Jury's out a little bit more than we thought.
Yeah, they got to smash some more shit together.
Yeah. Protons.
All right. Protons. Thanks, Bob. Or one more quick news item. Jay, the food babe is in a little bit of hot water again.
Yeah, this one is just so deep with BS. She keeps proving to us that she doesn't do research and that her topics are basically represented on the fifth grade level. That's how I summarize.
No, I think that's doing a disservice to fifth graders.
Yeah, I remember being in fifth grade and learning what the atmosphere was made of. So, yeah, I think Steve's right on this.
So she recently posted a blog post that covers airline travel and all the things that people run into, health risks and whatnot that happens to you while you're on an airplane. I'm going to quote her right out of the gate. This is her quote. A few facts about what airplanes do to your body. When your body is in the air at a seriously high altitude, your body undergoes some serious pressure. Just think about it. Airplanes thrive in places we don't. You are traveling in a pressurized cabin, and when your body is pressurized, it gets really compressed. Compression leads to all sorts of issues. First off, your body's digestive organs start to shrink, taxing your ability to digest large quantities of food. Secondly, this compression reduces the ability for your body to normally circulate blood through your blood vessels. Okay, so she's confusing deep sea diving and riding in an airplane with a lack of pressure. Not more pressure, Vanna, a lack of pressure. So she thinks that when you're in an airplane, you're in a pressurized cabin, they're pressurizing it more than it would be at sea level, as an example, say, right? Mm-hmm. What's actually happening is that when you go up into an airplane, you're in a pressurized cabin. The air pressure is slowly going down as you gain in altitude, and the airplane cabin is pressurizing the cabin at around 5,400 to 7,000 feet, which is roughly a quarter of the actual altitude that most airliners travel at. So, at 5,400 feet, the air pressure is easily, you can survive at 5,400 feet without a problem. You could actually survive at 10,000 feet without a problem. So you are in a comfortable zone there where you're getting enough oxygen and everything is fine. Now, the pressurized cabin is also a reduction in humidity. Now, she claims that there's a reduction of down by 40% humidity. That's not true. All the research that I did was saying more around 20%. She goes on later to mention that the air you are breathing on an airplane is recycled from directly outside of your window. That means you are breathing everything that the airplane gives off and is flying through. The air that is pumped in isn't pure oxygen either. It's mixed with nitrogen, sometimes almost 50%. Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
I'm just flabbergasted. Okay,
everything she said was wrong there.
Yeah, okay. So let me just...
she's batting 1,000.
Airplane air is partly recirculated and partly pumped in from the outside. And at high altitudes, the air outside is very cold. Yeah, it's drier than air at sea level. But this air is actually typically very clean. And that clean outside air gets recirculated into the cabin air. And there's a complete refresh of air in the cabin every 2 to 3 minutes. Also, the cabin air is highly filtered. They filter 97 to 99.9% of the particulate and germs that are in the air. So it's actually a lot cleaner than most of the places that you spend the vast majority of your time. You wouldn't think that, but actually the air in an airplane is damn clean. She's saying that the air is recycled directly from outside your window. Like, is she confusing this or thinking that fumes from the exhaust of the jet engines is getting into the airplane? No, that's not happening.
I think that's what she's saying. Yeah. Ridiculous.
She's also saying that the air, this whole thing about the oxygen, that they're not pumping in pure oxygen. Oh, my God.
That's actually
I'm sorry. If the atmosphere was 100% pure oxygen, every time somebody turned on their stove, turned on their car, lit a match, oh, anything with enough
plugged
heat.
Plugged in an electronic device.
Yeah, the entire atmosphere would go up.
But we'd be super high.
She should read about the Apollo 1 disaster. Mm-hmm. When they, you know, they were testing the Apollo capsules, they had pure oxygen in the cabin, and one little spark caused a raging fire that killed the, you know, three Apollo astronauts.
So the atmosphere is not 100% oxygen. It's 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, 1% CO2, and some other gases. But for her to think that the atmosphere is 100% oxygen is a great view into the window of her scientific understanding.
Yeah, see, that's where a fifth grader would have it all over her. I mean, really. So she clearly thinks, you know, from her writing that the atmosphere is 100% oxygen. See, and then she also frames it in a way that she's saying the airline is essentially contaminating our pure oxygen with this nitrogen, and because they're doing it to save money.
Yeah, there's this. Like some type of conspiracy theory behind
anti-corporation.
Where did she even get that? Yeah. I mean, where did she? That's like in the 50% number. I mean, that's, is she just making that up? I have no idea where that could have possibly have come from.
She gives no references to anything.
Yeah, no references. Yeah.
She says, before you fly, choose a seat as close to the front as possible. Pilots control the amount of airflow, and it is always better in their cabin. I'm sorry. That is just a flat, ignorant statement.
It's a lie. It's not true.
Made up. Just made up.
So for most planes, the pilots have zero control over the air circulation. It's set to automatic. You know, some airlines, the pilots basically have a high, normal, and low setting. They have a high setting which circulates the air more quickly if they feel like they need to refresh the cabin. And they have a low setting if there aren't that many passengers on the plane. Or if in an extreme case, they need to conserve fuel. But 99% of the time, it's in the normal setting. The pilots are not tweaking the airflow, and they're not giving themselves the most airflow. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, or the good air, whatever.
The good air,
right?
Yeah. For the vast majority of planes, it's like it's on automatic, and the pilots have zero control over the airflow.
Those damn pilots bogarting all the time.
Oh, hell yeah.
Bogarting.
Stealing my oxygen, pilots.
Dude. God.
So she says, bring your own food. Airport and airplane food is overly processed and contains more GMO, pesticides, MSG. Hey, Vanna, sorry, MSG, not bad for you. And chemicals. Ask your acupuncturist or naturopath for herbs that can help you prevent you from contracting colds, flus, and other viruses through the recycled air.
Yeah.
She's okay. Really going for woo of the year, isn't she? She's all in.
Check this out. Then she gives an 8 or 9 point list here. Things to do. 1, drink 8 ounces of water for every hour of flying time. Oh, really? So when we fly to Australia, I'm going to be in the air 22 hours. Insane, really? 8 ounces per hour? Really? There's not enough bathrooms on there.
Well, okay, let me clarify that. This is the one thing that she gets into where actually the advice is reasonable, and that is the air is dry on an airplane, and especially on intercontinental flights. So when we're flying from California to Sydney, the humidity in the cabin, according to one study that I found, could average about 5%. That's dry. So you do need, I do recommend, especially on long flights, especially on intercontinental flights, that you do have lots of fluid with you. Don't count on the timeliness of the flight attendants, that you have, you know, you do want to drink a lot of fluid and to keep ahead of the hydration. Also, I would, you know, this is standard. This is, again, this is sort of standard, partly common sense, partly any place you go will tell you the same thing. You know, lip balm, hand moisturizer.
Don't say bomb though.
And yeah, to keep your mucous membranes and your lips and everything from getting dry, because that will happen. But the 8 ounces every hour, that's just made up. There's no evidence for that. It's drink as much as you need to drink to keep well hydrated, but have access to fluid when you're on the plane.
The second one, if you experience a headache, pains or aches, think about using turmeric, garlic, or willow bark, which are all natural alternatives to aspirin.
Willow.
Yeah.
Or take aspirin.
Just take aspirin.
Which is as natural as it gets, by the way. It's the bark of a tree.
It's the willow bark, yeah. But Rebecca, you don't want to purify it. you need all those contaminants. You don't want to know what dose you're getting. You want to make sure the dose is as random as possible.
She says, fast or eat small, light carbohydrate-rich whole foods. Okay,
based
wrong.
On nothing.
Based on nothing. You're going to fast? Okay, I'm not going to eat for 22 hours? I don't think so. I can't go without for 3 hours. The limit any heavy dairy or protein-rich foods. No basis on science whatsoever. Whole grain carbohydrates are better tolerated than proteins at a high altitude. You completely just made that up while you were sitting there in first class on other people's money. Do not drink alcohol or caffeine on long flights. Duh. Yeah. Okay. Everybody knows
that's
that.
Fair. That's reasonable. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
reasonable.
Yeah.
7. Walk or stretch every 30 minutes. Yes. Not bad.
Also reasonable.
Not bad advice, but also, you know, no stretch of intellect there. 8. Keep your hands clean with natural hand sanitizers, spray, and avoid touching your face as much as possible. This goes anywhere you are ever. You should do that. And then she says, don't forget to take your natural herbs that can strengthen your immune system. Yeah. No, because yeah. that's not proven either.
There are no herbs, and quote unquote strengthening the immune system is a myth anyway. So yeah, it's just her typical, it's like a complete mixture of misinformation, gross scientific illiteracy, fear mongering, and some common knowledge thrown in there. And then her ideological alternative medicine nonsense on top. All right. Evan, this is the last Who's That Noisy, really before the end of the year.
Oh, that's right. Last week's Who's That Noisy. Well, I'll play it for you. Here we go. What was that?
Penguins snoring.
Yes, penguins. Rebecca.
Was it?
Yes, not snoring, but it is penguins.
What kind of penguins?
Gentoo penguins. Gentoo. This is something that, well, we all are familiar with penguins. We've all been familiar with it since, you know, we were kids, basically. But do we ever really hear what a penguin sort of sounds like? Well, maybe in cartoons and stuff, but actually hearing them, unless you've seen them in person, perhaps not. And that's why probably only a very few amount of people got this one correct, although there's some really, really interesting guesses of all sorts of animals. But there can be only one winner each week, and Lucas Jones, you are this week's winner. Congratulations very much. Your name is going into the hat.
And I guess we'll announce the winner at the end of the year episode?
We will do exactly that, and then we'll arrange to have him on in early 2015, and they're going to join us for an episode of Science or Fiction.
Great. Good job, Evan. So before we go on to Science or Fiction, I want to mention that the next episode that we'll be recording at home, I mean, other than the episodes that we're doing, on our trip, is going to be the year-end wrap-up episode. So as with all previous years, we need our listeners to send us their vote for their favorite episode, favorite interview, science news item of the year, skeptic of the year, gullible jackass of the year, favorite SGU moment of the year. Send us all that in, and we will put that together and read the best of them at the end of the year wrap-up episode. All right, guys. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. All right, we got 3 news items this week. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Si, senor. Yes.
Here we go. New research indicates that a stimulant drug, modafinil, enhances cognitive performance for those at the low end of the spectrum, but impairs performance for healthy individuals. Item number 2, the USDA has approved a new genetically modified potato that has 40% of the calories of existing cultivars typically used for chips and fries. And item number 3, new research in mice finds an association between the type of bacteria found in the gut and the presence of mental behaviors suggestive of anxiety, depression, and autism. Jay, go first.
Okay, the one about the drug that increases cognitive performance, people that are on the low end of the spectrum, but impairs people on the high end. That is very interesting, and I think that makes some sense. I could see how a stimulant might be able to help some people, but if you're functioning normally and you have a certain amount of that stimulant, that it could actually impair you. Yeah, sure, I could see that. Yeah, the second one here about a genetically modified potato. That's another one. I think, yeah, why not? They could have easily bred a potato or genetically modified a potato to have some different properties like that. This is why, you know, I think that they're doing it. 40% might be a lot, and that would be the only thing that would make me not believe it. But on the surface, I see that as being perfectly cromulent. Yeah, this last one about the study of mice, and they find that the type of gut bacteria can have an effect on a mouse's anxiety, depression, and autism. So the only thing I can think of with this is that the gut bacteria could have some type of interaction chemically with the creature. So that could have an effect. I don't like the idea here that it also states autism. You know, I'm going to go with that one as the fake.
Okay, Bob?
With Daffodil. Yeah, I have a little bit of a problem with this one. I could see it helping people at the lower end of the intelligence spectrum. But my gut would say that it would have just no effect on if you were smarter. It just seems a little weird that it would have the opposite effect. The potato, I really hope that's true. That would be fantastic. 40% is fairly significant. I mean, isn't a potato pretty much all carbohydrate? And the mouse one, I really don't have much of a problem with that. I think there's so little we know about the bacteriome and its impact on all sorts of aspects of animal physiology that wouldn't surprise me. But I agree with Jay that the autism does give me pause on that one. But I'm going to go with the modafinil drug one and say that's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
The potato thing is what is throwing me. I know that there's a problem with obesity. I know that it's a health issue and that worth exploring many options for how to fix it. But that said, I just can't imagine that in a day and age when we have so much research going into how to make foods more calorie dense, like peanut butters and things like that, in order to help starving children, that they would be working on how to make a potato with fewer calories. So I'm going to go with the potato thing as being the fiction.
Okay. And Devin?
The reason why I think the potato one is fiction is because new genetically modified potato. Well, where's the anti-GMO crowd on this? Isn't this something that they would have been all up in arms about and would have made in headlines, and we would have been hearing something about that aspect of this, which would have led us to this story? I have a feeling not much in this story at all is going to wind up being true. So that's why I'm thinking the potato one's fiction.
All right. So we have Bob for the modafinil, Evan and Rebecca for the potato, and Jay for the bacteria. So we have a nice spread. So I'll take these in order.
No sweep this week.
Sorry, Bob.
Hey, I love the everyone. Even spread is perfect. That's what I always like to say.
Wait, why'd you say sorry?
New
because
research.
He's starting with number one.
Sometimes I start with the fiction.
You have never. Well,
that's
okay,
not true.
Like
it's not true.
10% of the time.
And usually when we're spread out, I just take them in order, whatever that is. Okay, anyway. New research indicates that a stimulant drug, modafinil, enhances cognitive performance for those at the low end of the spectrum, but impairs performance for healthy individuals. Bob thinks that one is the fiction, and that one is science. Sorry, Bob. Sorry. So, yeah, this is interesting. Interesting. So modafinil is a stimulant. It's used to treat narcolepsy, and people are using it as a quote-unquote smart pill. One review survey showed that 20% of college students have taken it before exams or to help them study. But here's the thing. It actually doesn't help unless you are already at sort of the low end of the performance spectrum. And there's a very good explanation why. So as stimulants do, they tend to increase the functioning of our frontal lobes, including our executive function. And because that's such a huge part of the brain, that improves your attention and your executive function, but at the expense of slowing down your overall processing because you're doing more complex processing, so it's going to be slower. For people who are performing at the low end of the spectrum, they will test more slowly, but more accurately. People who are healthy, you don't have to be even above average, just somebody who's just healthy, they perform slower, but not more accurately. So if you're already essentially optimized in terms of the balance between your executive function and your accuracy or how optimally you're processing information, a stimulant's just not going to help, but it will slow you down because now you're It's like you're focusing more. You're spending more time engaging your frontal lobe. So it's slowing things down, but there's no benefit because you already have gotten the benefit that you're going to get out of increased concentration. Does that make sense?
I'm not even paying attention.
Okay.
It's already given up.
All right, so that one is science. Let's move on to number two. The USDA has approved a new genetically modified potato that has 40% of the calories of existing cultivars typically used for chips and fries. Evan and Rebecca think this one is the fiction, and this one is the fiction.
Aha!
Ooh, wow.
Double crap.
Wait a minute.
So,
that's directed at Rebecca or me?
But
I said double.
The USDA has just approved a GMO potato. It was genetically engineered, not by Monsanto, by Simplot, S-I-M-P-L-O-T, Simplot, they are like one of the major Idaho potato growers, and they, among other things, they provide the potatoes for McDonald's. They engineered a potato that produces significantly less, about 40% of a chemical that in mice has been linked to cancer. So not proven that it causes cancer in humans. This is acrylamide. And when you fry potatoes, the existing potatoes, they can form acrylamide, which maybe it's called a suspected human carcinogen. Maybe it isn't. In any case, they said, okay, well, we'll genetically modify a potato that forms less of it. The potatoes also don't bruise easily, so they're bruise resistant, which is helpful in transporting the potatoes, right? Because they won't get bruised up just by being shipped around. Also, this is not transgenic, meaning that the gene that they inserted doesn't come from another kingdom or species. It comes from other wild potatoes. So they're basically taking genes from the wild potatoes and putting them into commercial potatoes, and that will reduce the bruising or black spots that can occur on potatoes and reduce the acrylamide that gets produced in frying.
Cool.
Yeah. By the way, there was a second GMO approved in the last couple of weeks. The American chestnut tree. You guys know this story?
No.
The American chestnut was one of the most common trees in the eastern United States.
Oh, cool.
50 years ago, there were chestnut trees all over the place. They have been virtually wiped out by a fungus. So now there are no American chestnut trees anymore.
None?
Were they delicious?
They're chestnuts, Jay.
Yeah, but you say American, it was a different version?
Well, whatever. That's the name of the tree. The chestnuts that you know come from the American chestnut. There's a Chinese chestnut tree. The ones that you know is from the American chestnut tree.
Those have a fortune inside.
Right. So they have approved for planting in the wild genetically modified American chestnut trees that are resistant to the fungus. Essentially, they can live and thrive even with the fungal infection. So the fungus is still capable of infecting them. It just won't harm them. And so it becomes more of just almost like a nosocomial kind of thing where it's there, but it's not causing any problems. This is the first genetically modified organism approved for planting in the wild, which is interesting.
Okay.
And may lead to the return of the American chestnut in the eastern part of the United States.
Awesome. That's awesome. Hey. Maybe that'll bring the prices down.
Okay, let's go on to number three. New research in mice finds an association between the type of bacteria found in the gut and the presence of mental behaviors suggestive of anxiety, depression, and autism. And that one, of course, is science. And I wouldn't say, Rebecca, that this has been confirmed. This is still controversial. There is still a great deal of skepticism about whether or not this link exists. But this new study definitely pushes it significantly in that direction. So this makes it more accepted that there really is a connection here. But in any case, it is looking good for this hypothesis that maybe there is some association between gut bacteria and brain function. In this particular case, anxiety, depression, and behaviors in mice that we think of as being analogous to autism. Obviously, you can't like diagnose autism in mice, but there are behaviors suggestive of autism. Beyond finding an association, they also, in fact, would, at least in one study, take the bacteria associated with anxiety, gave it to another mouse strain, and then they started acting anxious too. So it does seem to be that the bacteria is causing the behavior and not the other way around. Although again, this is still one of the open questions. And of course, this is in mice. So it's really hard to know how this is going to translate to people. People have more complicated brains than mice do. And it's just, this is exactly the kind of thing for which animal models may not be a really good guide. So even the researchers who were doing this research and finding the link are very skeptical of the notion that it's going to lead to any treatments for people. We're still a long way away of closing that loop. Of like actually treating your gut bacteria in order to treat depression, for example, or anxiety. That'd be nice. It'd be awfully nice if we could just give you some probiotics and treat your depression. And that there may come the day where we're like giving you genetically modified gut bacteria that are, you know, whatever, that are beneficial rather than harmful. And the thinking is that the bacteria are secreting something which is interacting with the brain. They think it's probably most profound during development, so in young children, infants, but it may just have an effect on brain function, which is not implausible. You know, the brain's an organ, it responds to chemicals, and bacteria can produce chemicals. There's also a notion that it may only occur in certain people who have quote-unquote leaky guts, which I'm not sure has been as fully established either, but that have GI systems which allow for stuff, you know, larger chemicals to go from the intestines into the bloodstream. So there's a lot of questions still with this research, but the mere association is made stronger by this most recent study. All right, so good work, Evan and Rebecca.
Thank you.
Thanks. I was right for the wrong reason, but that's
all right. Okay. You'll take it. All right, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have a really nice quote sent in by a listener named Simon McPherson from Virginia Beach, Virginia in the United States. And the quote is, "The voice of reason is small, but very persistent." That was a quote. I'm not sure if the quote was spoken by Sigmund Freud, but it was definitely on his memorial.
Mm-hmm.
"The voice of reason is small, but very persistent."
Dr. Sigmund von Freudendassen!
Und his orchestra.
All right, guys. The next time we all talk will be in Canberra.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'll see you there.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
It's going to be super fun.
Epic.
All right, guys, so we'll see you all down under.
Yeah, Rebecca, have a great time with David, and hopefully we will see you safe and sound in Sydney.
Yeah, I'll see some of you listeners in Hong Kong and China, and the rest I will see in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
I'll see you guys there.
And we'll all be at Fremont, California at Ohlone College, and then we'll hook up with Rebecca in Canberra.
Yeah.
All right, guys, well, until next week, and we're down under, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.